Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite transatlantic football podcast, back for the second time in a week, and happy 4th of July to all of our American listenership. My name's Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today. And joining me across the water, all the way from Mission Beach today, is Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Hello, mate. Happy 4th. Yep, early start here, obviously, with the kids going wild. You may hear that during the course of this podcast. Who knows? But, mate, more importantly, we're about 12 hours on from one of the best World Cup games of all time. I mean, I don't know what time it went on till for you, but definitely early hours. But I had, you know, I'm in a house for this weekend with friends that don't really like football. A couple of the lads loosely like football. They come to a few San Diego FC games. The wives don't care. The kids generally don't care, apart from Dylan Reese. Everyone was absolutely captivated by Cape Verde. It was brilliant. Like, everyone's looking up on a map where they are. Everyone's coming up with stats about the players, about Vizinha, about every, like, it was exactly what the World Cup is all about. You know, even though they didn't manage to get the job done, even though they lose 3-2, in the end, it doesn't really matter because they've won. Like, as a country, like, this has quite literally put them on the map for millions of people.
I did see some funny tweets about this. I saw Piers Morgan be like, I'd never even heard of Cape Verde. I was like, what do you mean?
How's he not heard of it?
Like, you're a journalist and it's a country.
Yeah. That's ridiculous. Like, I wasn't sure where it was. But I've heard people go on holiday there and stuff. But yeah, a lot of the Americans literally had no idea. Like, and they all want to go there. We might even go there as like a group holiday next year on the back of this.
I mean, I think I've seen quite a lot of this, right? Like, it's, I saw someone tweet this and I can't remember for the life of me who it was, so I do apologize. But it was like the World Cup is a front porch for nations and like selling themselves for holidays. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I think so many
people. Best tourism advertising you could ever do, isn't it?
100%. And look, my aunt and uncle go there quite like semi-regularly. They went a couple of years back and they just fell in love with the place and have gone back every year since. And they're always like, you need to go. And a big shout out, actually, I haven't been keeping an eye as much as I usually do with the Copa 90 things that have been going on over the course of the year. I normally watch all of kind of Ellie's stuff religiously, but he's been doing a series during the course of the World Cup called the World's Cup, where he's been traveling around. He went to Uzbekistan for their first ever game. He was in Cape Verde for the Uruguay game. He was in Paraguay for their win over Germany. He was in Ecuador. There's lots of different episodes, but the Cape Verde one is absolutely amazing. Really, really worth your time. It's about 20 minutes on YouTube, but it is, you know, brilliant. And Ellie's the best in the world at those kind of short length football feature culture documentaries, I think. But it's just a really captivating watch about what it means to the country, what it means to the people. And I think now that they've captured the hearts of the world, that video is very much going to skyrocket, I'm sure, which I'll deserve. I mean, it's just incredible what you're seeing.
How are they so good?
Do you want the answer to that question? I think.
Yeah.
I think I know the answer to that question. They do the fundamentals brilliantly. Like, they do the basics really, really, really well. They play to the strengths of their individual players and the team knows exactly what it's doing. It's an incredibly well put together back line. You know, there's a couple of star players in there and obviously everyone's talking about Sidney Lopes-Cabral today, but, you know, he's kind of been on the radar for a little while. He was at Benfica. He's played in the Champions League at the Bernabeu this season. He's one of the players that, you know, when you looked at that Cape Verde list, I was like, oh, okay, I know who that is. I know who a couple of these players are before you go and do the research. Like, he was one that stood out, be like, oh, okay, you're already kind of playing top level. He's just made a move, I think, to Trabzonspor for around 10 million euros before the World Cup. They are going to be very grateful.
They'll be able to sell him for about 50
now. That's it. They got that deal done. They also have Christian Aouelai of Cote d'Ivoire, who obviously had some very impressive performances as well. So they're absolutely in the money, Trabzonspor, I think, going into the next bit. But the point being that, you know, this was a team that lent into what it was doing. It had absolutely no fear. And I think that, you know, they were built on a very strong defensive foundation. And a lot of talk is centered around Vezina. I actually think that, you know, maybe as much credit, if not slightly more, deserves to go to that back line in front of him, who were absolute rocks. Dine Borges, Pico Lopes, whose story is now widely shared about being recruited on LinkedIn, you know, for there. Grew up in Crumlin in Dublin, has played his entire life pretty much in the League of Ireland, was at I think it was a Bohemians, and then for a long time has been Shamrock Rovers. They want him back. They'll be delighted they're out, by the way, because they've got a first Champions League qualification tie against Floriana of Malta this week. He's going to be straight back in for because that's a big one for them. But like, this is a group that has just been coached incredibly well. Bubista has coached the lights out of this team. And when you actually look at what they've put together in terms of their performances, it has not been, you know, sit back and low block everything. Yes, I think they employed that tactic for the most part against Spain, but you see them go out and play against Uruguay. You saw them come out and play yesterday against Argentina. This was not hanging in by the skin of their teeth. They were playing. And I think that, you know, sometimes it's easy to overplay the Cinderella story, right? They topped their group in CAF qualification. They are a team who has already gone on a quarterfinal run in AFCON. They're not kind of completely out of the blue. But I think that for the majority of the football watching world, these things potentially slide by, which is totally fair enough. But I do think that sometimes the Cinderella story aspect of it is a little bit overblown. They were, you know, a group winners. They did not qualify through the back door like someone like a DR Congo did, for example. They very much were here on merit, and they proved that over and over again. It is a tale that's captivated everybody, and I am absolutely delighted for them, because it couldn't have happened, you know, to a team that, you know, enthralled the world in a better way. I think it was such a beautiful thing to watch, and them going out, they had Argentina on the ropes in those last couple of minutes.
They did, mate. I thought they might even do it. I mean, they haven't lost a game in 90 minutes. They're out of the World Cup. This is like an old school World Cup story. It's like, go throwback to like when Cameroon were in Italia 90 or something, and like they arrive on the scene, they start capturing the hearts, and it's great because there are very, very few teams and players that you don't know much about anymore, right? It's very rare that this can happen. But this team blindsided everybody, and they've come here with a game plan, a philosophy, a way of playing that was just such a joy. Like, I actually enjoyed it whenever Argentina scored, because it meant that we saw Cape Verde attack, and they couldn't really do that as much in between. But they were really good at it. But yeah, and like, once it went to 2-2, it felt like we needed a break so they could actually properly celebrate. You know, the geezer's literally in the stand looking for his family. Like,
That man is so in love. Imagine scoring that goal in the World Cup and your first thought being, I'm going to go and find my girlfriend. I absolutely love it.
Right, it's funny because that's the sort of thing you would do.
Yeah, that is...
but yeah, it was a brilliant story. It's been unbelievable, and genuinely, I mean, I tweeted about it. I don't tweet anymore. I barely ever tweet, and I was like, I've got to have a release of emotion here, and just get this out to the world that like that was a proper World Cup story. Sadly, they're out.
But
sadly, as an Englishman, Argentina march on. But
there's something about that, though, because like, we talk about these kind of fairy tale runs to an extent in certain competitions, and obviously there are different levels to this. But like what Bodo Glimt did in the Champions League this year, I think was a little bit kind of, it kind of ran out of steam, right? And that second leg against Sporting, where they threw away a lead, kind of took the gloss off it a little bit. And I think that if Cap Verde had gone to penalties and whatever and won and then lost 1-0 to Egypt in the next round, it would have taken a little bit of shine off this story. Maybe I'm overthinking it, right? And I'm happy to do it.
No.
I bastardized a quote yesterday from The Commitments, which is my favorite film ever. And it was like, sure, Cap Verde could have won on penalties and reached quarterfinals and stuff, but that would have been predictable. This way, it's poetry. And I feel like especially if Argentina, and I look, we'll talk about the favorites and who's, you know, looking best right now. If Argentina were to go on to win this, and the team that ran them closest was this Cap Verde thing, I think it would probably enhance their legend even further, rather than, you know, losing to someone who might not get as far in the competition. I don't know if that makes sense, but like in my head, it does.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Before we move on, like on the flip side of it, the thing that blew my mind yesterday was Australia substituting their goalkeeper, who'd had a great game.
Great tournament, Patrick B.
Great tournament. and bringing on Ryan for the Pens, and he don't touch the ball.
He dived three out of four times.
He dived the wrong way twice. Like, you can't, like, the other kids are like, I could have done that. What? I just don't know how I feel about this. Like,
the mayor here, right? Like, he's made the goalkeeper switch. And look, it's one of those where if he'd made the goalkeeper switch and they'd won, he would have been lauded as a genius.
Of course.
You fundamentally live and die by your decisions, right? And this decision has not gone well, and therefore you're going to be absolutely criticised to high heaven on it. But the other thing was, you know, letting an 18-year-old centre-back take a penalty. You know, I was on the radio at the time with Rodney Marsh, and he was like, he looks like he's still doing his paper round. I was like, Rodney's 6'4". I don't think he could do his paper round. But even with that said, it was like one of those ones where you're like, really? And maybe this isn't on the manager. Maybe this is on some of the other players within this side. But, you know, there were senior players there not stepping up for penalties. And I just think that, you know, you're looking at it and thinking, poor old Lucas Herrington, you know, plays for the Colorado Rapids. He's stepped up there at that moment. He's hit the bar. It's not a terrible penalty, but it's not a great penalty either. And, you know, either he's got, you know, the world's biggest bottle, right? And he's just gone, yeah, coach, put me in, I want one. But it didn't look like it from the way that he walked up to the ball, or not enough senior players to step forward. I got to say, that is a difficult way for Australia to exit this tournament, I would say.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, ultimately, I don't know that they deserve to be in the list. I don't know that they don't deserve to be in it, but I don't know that they could put forward a massive case that they are wholly deserving.
Well, Egypt edged it. They've much in the game.
Egypt edged it. And I, you know, would Australia have had a chance of beating Argentina and put on a Cape Verde start? They might. They're obviously, they've got a lot of energy. They can be disciplined and all these sorts of things. But I think I'm more excited about the prospect of Egypt having a go at them.
I think for me, this was a very young Australia team. There was a couple of obviously kind of senior heads in there, actually mostly coming off the bench, which is why the penalty thing was even more surprising. But I think that it is, there's plenty of positives to take from this for the Socceroos. There was a lot of young players who stood up and were counted. I thought that Herrington had a brilliant game up to that point, right? And I think someone like an Ocon Engstler has been a bit of a breakthrough star as far as I'm concerned. We've seen a lot of young players in this Australia side make a World Cup debut, and it's something that I kind of wanted to talk about. We're effectively just reversing the podcast now, because I was going to end this podcast, but in terms of talking and saying goodbye to some of the teams that we've loved, but we may as well go with it now, because you know, I feel a little bit similarly, not quite to the same degree about Australia as I do with Cote d'Ivoire. Like, I look at this Ivory Coast team and I think, wow, the amount of talent in, especially in that forward line, but who are all sort of 23 or under, but also there's a couple of very young defenders in there who maybe didn't get as many minutes as we might have expected. Ousmane Diamande, for example, of Sporting, but also Kasunu's still quite young. The goalkeeper, Yaya Fofana, is still very young in goalkeeping terms. He's 25 years old. I think similar for Australia, you know, Patrick Beach at 22, putting that kind of performance in at a World Cup. Nestori Arankunda kind of announced himself. Mo Torre had plenty of minutes. There's a lot to like about this Australia setup going forward. And now they've all got experience of not just playing at a World Cup, and I would say the same for the Ivory Coast, but also coming through and getting out of a group stage, playing in a knockout game. The Ivory Coast have never been out of the group before. Australia have, but again, have never won a knockout stage game. I think that this group will be back stronger in 4 years' time, you know, with a lot of young talent in there. Someone like Christian Volpato, who I think has only completed less dribbles than like Kylian Mbappe and Ousmane Dembele. I think there's three players that have done it, so I'm not going to quite name them all, but like, he's an unbelievable company considering the lack of minutes he got. There's a really exciting core of players here with Australia, as there is with Cote d'Ivoire. I'm sad to see them both go, because I thought that they were fun in very different ways. More so the Ivory Coast, who I genuinely think could have made a run maybe to the quarterfinals of this tournament. But I think that there is plenty of optimism for both of those nations going forward about what this new group, who've already had that taster of World Cup football, can achieve over the next 4-8 years.
Yeah, definitely the case. And it's good that you get that sense of motivation on this stage too. It's all very well doing it in qualification or in friendlies or having the odd win, but to come here, do it consistently and prove something to the world. You know, we've seen with Morocco how that sense of momentum can work well. And even, you know, Morocco, to be fair, are still considered underdogs a lot of the time when they shouldn't be. But Ivory Coast and teams like that can play on that, because they have become a lot of people's favourite second team, if you like, or just a team that you want to tune in for the joy of it. 100%. And then you start to see a few breakout stars along the way that across the course of next year, I think we'll be seeing more and more of.
Yeah, 100%. So, a fond farewell to, I think, Cap Verde first and foremost, and ahead of everyone else, the story of this World Cup, and the one I think that will live on. One of the great World Cup debuts. Like, if you discount Uruguay in 1930 and Italy in 1934, who obviously won the tournament in their first goes at it, like, this is one of, I think, at the very least, maybe the great modern World Cup debut. And I think it's something that we will all be talking about for many, many years to come. So shout out to the Blue Sharks of Cap Verde. They have been an incredible story and one that I'm going to be looking out for at AFCON over the next couple of years to see if they can build on this foundation. Right, we're going to take a break there. When we come back on the other side, we're going to talk about who's in the best shape now with the round of 32 complete. And then later on in the program, we're also going to talk about can the hosts keep going in this tournament, and a couple of dark horses. Can you have dark horses in the round of 16? We'll discuss. Right, stick with us. Welcome back to Ranks AFC. It's Jack Collins and Dean Jones alongside you. And let's talk a little bit, DJ, about who is in the best shape here going in. I think that there is a relatively clear one and two. And maybe the big question that we'll end up discussing is who's currently in third place. But I think that both of us are in firm agreement that of all of the football we've seen so far, no one's quite held a candle to what France have been doing yet. And they are many people's favourites in tournament for a very good reason.
Yeah, I mean, they've set the pace. If you look across the 12 groups, there's no one that's made the sort of impact that France made on the tournament. We expected them to be very good coming in. They might have even exceeded expectations, to be honest with you. Mbappe showing he's going to be a leading candidate at the moment, going head-to-head with Messi for that golden boot. But around him, Ousmane Dembele, Michael Olise, the leading assist returner as we head into this last 16. They're averaging more goals a game than anyone else. I think only Brazil have more expected goals than them. They play front-footed. They can defend really well. They're favourites to win this tournament for a reason. I mean, the one thing that you could put against them is that they might put too much emphasis on attack when they come up against a really top team. So once we get into that final four, maybe in one of those last two games, something gets exposed in terms of them being too attack-minded, being too good in that sense, and that they get caught out because their two-man midfield could get overwhelmed. But, I'm trying to find flaws at this point, to be honest, if I'm going to dig that deep. They're a team that I absolutely would not be looking forward to England facing. They're just great, mate. And we obviously knew this. And we know the depth chart that they've got, that they could have two or three different teams that they field and still be one of the best teams in the tournament. But the fact is, we're getting their A team at the moment, and that is scary.
I think this is it, right? Like, and one of the things I find really interesting about this France team is it's quite like not Deschamps. It's quite un Deschamps, considering it's his last tournament. It's almost like he's been like, go on then. Let's just see what happens if I let the hand break off, right? And just let this front four loose to create the amount of damage that they have. And, you know, you shut down, which is, almost a non-impossible task as it is, to play tournament Mbappe, who just comes alive every single time that there's a World Cup, and Michael Olise, who is in the kind of creative form of his life. So it's a pretty kind of arduous and, as I say, Herculean task to shut those two down in the first place. And then you're like, oh, don't worry, it's just Ballon d'Or winner Ousmane Dembele on the other flank, and either Desiré Doué or Bradley Barcola, who might be the quickest of the lot of them when it comes to it, like, yeah, in terms of on the other flank. And that, I think, is the scary bit. The question I suppose I have is what Deschamps does next, right? Because he is and has been traditionally a quite conservative manager. We've looked at the France teams in the past, and yes, they've been absolutely unbelievably dazzling at times in terms of the players and the movements that they can make. But you'll remember him playing Blaise Matuidi on the left wing in 2018 in order to accommodate Paul Pogba in the center of the park and make sure that effectively they were shut the bolt first. you'll remember the teams that he's had and the criticism that faced him after Euro 2024, which was maybe that was, you know, the end of his powers. His powers coming to a wane because he wasn't able to get them scoring. They scored one goal from open play in the entire tournament of Euro 2024. Like, it was a really odd space for them to be in. And it feels like he's just completely U-turned and be like, yeah, okay, cool. We'll just hold a midfield two. We back our defensive line and we're just going to run riot in the final third. I think his natural instinct will be, you know, when he comes up against potentially a Spain, perhaps in a semi-final, we'll talk about in a second, to be like, might need to put an extra midfielder in there, might need to actually drag the 10 out of here and go 4-3-3 in order to combat Spain's midfield dominance, perhaps. And if he does that, does it kind of shake the balance of the team and what they've been doing? Does he have the ability to change it now when it's been working so well? That for me is the big question about them. And if he does go kind of full throttle all the way through, which again, I think is maybe a little bit more unlikely than people think, you know, is that actually something that they can do? Can they get into those midfield battles and how does it destabilize the team? But on the evidence we have in front of us so far, I don't think anyone has held a candle to what France have been able to put together. And also, they've probably had the hardest route through so far. I think maybe you could make an argument for Morocco, perhaps. But like, I think France, if you actually looked at it, the group that they've played against in terms of playing against Senegal, and then, okay, yes, a rotated Norway, but then Sweden, who had some firepower of their own and scored a multitude of goals in the group stages. That's not an easy run by, but it might have suited France as well.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, we all know that once we get to the tournament, it's when you face Argentina or Brazil or England or Portugal or Spain, whatever. Like, that's when your card's really marked. That's when we find out what you're really made of. And that's when we find out whether, you know, the combinations in the middle for France, whether it's Kone or Rabiot and Tchouaméni or whatever, that come together, whether they can hold it together. They probably can. Tchouaméni, by the way, a player that Man United fans should be keeping an eye on because they've stepped up interest in him recently as they look for midfield options. And he's kind of got a shop window there for himself at the moment. But I've not really got anything else to say about them because they are just too good. Like, there is nothing I can criticize. I expect France to be in the final, and that's that.
Okay, well, let's come on to...
They could lose today, by the way. We're recording this on Saturday. They're going to lose to Paraguay today. Well, and this whole podcast out the window.
Arguably the meanest defense in the entire competition coming up against it, his most fire attack. Yeah. So we will see. But I think that this might...
As we sit here right now, they are my number one rank.
I think it's reasonable to do this because otherwise we're never going to put a podcast out because this World Cup is moving so quickly. So takes can age very, very badly in the middle of a World Cup. But I think, you know, and they come up against maybe not firmer opposition in this next round. But Spain, I think for me, still sit at number two. They had a little bit of an inauspicious start, obviously that draw with Cap Verde, and then they hammered Saudi Arabia and sort of scored a goal and then played keep ball against Uruguay. But I thought that Spain's performance against Austria, one of the best counter-pressing teams in world football, the way that they just knocked the ball around them as if they weren't there, the fact that they have not conceded a goal, the fact they didn't concede a shot on target in that game against Austria, this game for me was where Spain arrived at the tournament. And if they do play like that, I think they stand the best chance of going toe-to-toe with France and coming out on the other side.
It's the first time we've seen a real representation of what Spain actually are. And I think it's the first time they've given themselves a sense of that. And they'll come off the field feeling like, okay, that's more us. Okay, that's better. We've had our warm-up period. We got through the group. Okay, fine. But now is when the real World Cup begins for us, and they've just taken Austria to pieces. Like, Austria didn't even do anything particularly wrong. Like, they've just been...
That's it, isn't it? It's the same point with France. I thought Sweden were quite good and they still lost 3-0. France hit the woodwork three times, had two goals disallowed, and Zetterstrom had a cracking game. Like, that, I think, is more applicable to these two than almost anybody else.
They just play with such ease and freedom, and it's the fluidity of it all. It makes me shiver at times, honestly, because like, it's just so good. It's so good. And the understanding between the players when a gap opens up of where they're going to hit the space, it's just unbelievable, mate. Like, it's just like, you give this side a sniff of space in between the lines or down the flanks and you're dead. And the way that Spain exploit it is just calm efficiency. Like, one of the things we've seen a lot of at this World Cup of, we're starting to see more of as people realise it, is the power with which you can score from long range, right? And we're seeing goalkeepers struggle at times to keep a ball out, which they sometimes might have. And I do think the effects of this ball and the conditions with which we've got.
New Jabulani.
Yeah, it's a little bit. We are seeing a bit more talk now about this ball.
It's not quite as clear as that. I feel like with the Jabulani, the only player that seemed to be able to work out how to use it was Diego Forlan. I think more people have worked out how to use the Trionda. But I do think there's a touch of it in the air.
There is, and I do genuinely think that it's something we're going to end up reading and talking about more as we now get to this stage of the competition, particularly the long range efforts that we're going to be seeing and are seeing. But for Spain, as I say, like, it's not really about that. It's about carving open true big chances and just calmly slotting them away. And we haven't. The other thing to take into account with Spain is that while we are seeing the best of Elise and Dembele and Mbappe, we haven't seen the best of Lamine Yamal yet. And I'm bracing myself for that. Now, obviously, we haven't got a fully 100% fit version of him at this World Cup, but given his youth and given his desperation to go into that bracket, I think we've still got some special times to come and that there is another level of Spain to be unlocked.
I got 2 points here. One, is Mikel Oyarzabal the most underrated player in world football from a global perspective?
I mean, I think he is, because I underrated him and you told me that at the start of this World Cup and I wasn't convinced, and now I see that I was wrong.
One of just an absolutely elite level footballer. I made this point on the radio and so I didn't quite get the response I was looking for from Rodney Marsh and Tommy Smith, but I do think that Oyarzabal could play, maybe not start, but I think that Mikel Oyarzabal could feature for any top side in the world. He's got such a brilliant footballing IQ. He understands space and he is the exact nine that Spain need in this system, because he isn't trying to kind of hog the spotlight. He is someone who facilitates as much as he can get on the end of things. But when he is in front of goal, he's absolutely ruthless as well. 4 goals already in this tournament. It does feel to me a little bit like you're kind of looking at a player who, you know, just should be considered in that bracket of elite nines at this point, but because he plays for Real Sociedad, perhaps doesn't get the shine that he perhaps deserves. But I love him immensely. The other point about this, and the reason I was going to say, the only reason I have Spain below France, because I think that their midfield is better. I think their grasp of controlling games is better than France's. I don't know if Spain have an effective plan B, and I don't think Luis de la Fuente will turn to the plan Bs that he does have, like someone like a Borja Iglesias, who is a big number nine that you could stick on and head the ball in the back of the net. I think that Deschamps, if they were really struggling to score a goal, which feels unlikely at this point, would just be like, right, get Mateta in there and swing some balls in and actually start to occupy these centre backs. I think de la Fuente would see that as a kind of personal affront on his own ideals of what football is, and therefore Spain's lack of one wingers, because everybody bar Lamine Yamal is injured. Jeremy Pino's injured. Nico Williams is struggling with injury as well. Victor Munoz, new Liverpool signing, is struggling with injury. I just don't know if Spain are 0-0 going into the 75th minute, if they have enough options in terms of plan B from an attacking standpoint to actually push a game over the line in a way that I wouldn't be worried about France. That's why I have them 1 and 2 like this.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, with the Oyarzabal as well, like, there's this golden boot race going on, right? And we presume right now it's emerged quite clearly that the bookies are like, it's going to be Mbappe or Messi that gets the golden boot, right? Messi's on 7, Mbappe's on 6. They're both now expected to get to the semi-finals at least. And that's where the value is. But mate, Oyarzabal's like 33-1. He's on 4 goals. Like, it doesn't take a lot for him to suddenly be there. He's not as iconic as some of the other names that are chasing them, like a Haaland or a Kane or whatever. But he is in the second best team that we've seen so far, we're seeing so far at this World Cup. And his job is literally to convert the chances that are being teed up for him by some of the best players in the world.
It's really annoying. So I put this on before the tournament. I got it.
Did you?
17s. So he's gone up, despite the fact he's on four goals. He's gone upwards in the, like,
this is what I couldn't understand, because I was looking at the odds yesterday and I was like, that's wild.
He's already 2-3 behind Mbappe and Messi, who were already favourites before. So as their odds drop, his have to increase.
But isn't that mad? Because, like, he's literally not doing anything wrong. He's filling his role, and Spain are starting to build. And his job's, like, obviously it's still a bit of a long shot, because you do expect that Messi or Mbappe is going to get that. And if it's not them, then maybe Kane can put himself into it. But behind those three, it's got to be him, isn't it? So like a 33-1 shot at this stage with potentially four games to play is not a bad bet.
No, no. I might cash that one out and re-put it on at 33.
Yeah, do it.
Rather than a sticking
with... Refinance your bet.
Well, okay, look, I think we're both in agreement that that's one and two. But I think what actually might be the most interesting question about this is, who's currently third in that race? I think you can make an argument for Morocco. I think you can make an argument for England. I think you can make an argument for Argentina, maybe Brazil. Portugal probably on the edge of that. I don't think Portugal have been particularly convincing, but they are an incredibly talented football team, and they come up against Spain next. If they were to win that game, it somehow kind of flips on its head. So who would you have third at this point?
This is hard, mate, because I'm going to be biased, aren't I?
I don't think it's a wild shout to put England here, considering they're half of the bracket, etc. If England win in Mexico, I expect them to get to the semifinals. I think that Miami will then feel like such a kind of, oh, back to reality, we just play our game. If England get through Mexico, I genuinely feel that they probably could be, at the very least, a semifinal, maybe a final team, which puts them in that conversation.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, okay, so the elite teams that I would have to compare us against, Argentina, Brazil, Portugal, right? And then you drop Morocco in just beneath, probably. But like, Argentina, okay, they've just had the scare of their lives against a minnow, right? Brazil had the scare of their lives, took a very late goal to get them through. Portugal, unconvincing. Morocco were a bit more convincing. Obviously, they play today, so I'm not going to go too much detail on them, but Morocco are a good team. And I'm like, England aren't really dropping that short of the standard, to be honest with you, because France and Spain are ahead, but England are doing as much as anyone else. And I know back home that a lot of people are very unconvinced, and, like, you know, I think people are being too hard on England to some extent, as well, as I said in the last pod. And I think that the chances created is worth looking into more than people have so far. There was 6, 7, 8 good chances that went begging. 6, 7, yeah. But Mexico is different because of the conditions, and obviously people are talking about the altitude and talking about the environment in which they're going to be sleeping, and like the Mexican fans are going to have so much input into the game. The Mexican team don't lose at the Azteca. These are all unknowns. I don't know how England cope with any of that. Are Mexico a better football team than England? No, they're not. Like, Mexico, I saw Brad Friedel talking, and he was like, look, Mexico are actually quite an average team, but they just have an X factor in this particular environment that counts for something different. But if you are actually weighing it up, then England should beat Mexico. And I do agree with that. Yeah. But
no, I think there is a slight differentiation I'd make there. England, Mexico are playing better than England are currently, but I would suggest that there is more of they're playing more than the sum of their parts, right? Which England currently aren't, I would suggest. Like, England don't feel like more than the sum of their parts at this point in the tournament. Mexico do, but that doesn't change the fact. And, you know, I've referenced this a couple of times, but to use an old Sam Tyerism, the team with the better players usually wins. And look, maybe the atmosphere and maybe the altitude, etc., is the great equalizer in all of that. But like the team with the better players usually wins, and England do have better players than Mexico. That said, I was looking at the odds for this the other day, and it's pretty much level, right, in terms of who goes through, which I think is kind of mad in some ways, and a testament to what they've been doing.
Yeah, look, this is how I would judge putting England next in line, is that, like, if we beat Mexico and we play Brazil in the quarterfinal, do I think we would beat Brazil? I do. And then in the semi-final, we would face Argentina. Where would I put us in that? It's very close, but I'm not as worried. I think that game, there's not really a lot in it, to be honest with you. Like, that could go either way. So I would say us and Argentina are probably on a level that's pretty even. But then beyond that, I'd probably throw Mexico into the conversation, to be honest, just because there is this would Mexico beat Brazil in the quarterfinal? Maybe. Maybe they would.
Yeah, I don't think that's a wild shout by any stretch of the imagination. You know, there is the great equalizer at World Cups. You come up against Brazil in that yellow kit and it's like, oh God, you've lost the game before it already begins, even if you know that this Brazil side is not one that ever exists. And look, some of this is all cliche, right? But there are elements of this that exist. And it is interesting kind of seeing how it all plays out. The other team that I might throw in here is Morocco. And I know Morocco haven't necessarily set the tournament on fire, right? Because it's been a couple of, you know, the first 20 minutes against Brazil, they were excellent. They drew that game. They win 1-0 against Scotland with a goal scored in the first minute. And then they have this kind of helter-skelter madhouse game against Haiti, which they end up on the right-hand side of. And then they beat the Netherlands on penalties. But I thought they were much the better side for most of that game against the Netherlands. And I think my theory on Morocco is that they are currently holding back a little bit, because I think that they are aware that what happened in Qatar was, by the time they got to the semi-finals, they were effectively broken, right? Roman Saiss, who was the captain, was out injured by that point. I think Mazraoui went off at halftime. Walid Regragui afterwards was like, all of our players are running on fumes. Like, we've got absolutely nothing left to give. And we still have only just been beaten by France, who, you know, were an unbelievable side at that point in a semi-final. I wonder if they're aware of what happened that time and are just maybe not hitting the throttle from the same way that they did in the last World Cup, because they're aware that there are higher expectations, and, you know, trying to match that would perhaps be, you know, seen as a huge, huge step forward for this program. So I think there's more to come from Morocco. They're in the harder side of this draw and in this bracket, and that's maybe where England and Argentina have the edge on them. But I think that it is interesting to see how they end up shaking out. I don't think you can put them in the dark horses category that we'll talk about in the next segment, because they were World Cup semi-finalists last time out. And they have been absolutely unbelievable pretty much ever since. But in terms of where they're at, I'm not quite sure I'm comfortable putting them third because of the side of the bracket they're in. If they were in England and Argentina side of the bracket, I would have them third, full stop here.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm assuming they beat Canada today. I think that's just going to prove a step too far for Canada, I would assume. But Morocco have evolved since the last World Cup, right? And they've not only, like, quite literally signed new players, but they've also changed the way that they play. So at the last World Cup, they ranked 27th out of 32 teams in terms of average possession. And at this World Cup, they are 9th. So they want more of the ball now. They want more control of a game now. And I think that comes with trusting themselves too, and that being that they have now moved up the food chain and that they can actually start to assert themselves on a tournament.
Yeah, I think that that's a good place to stick them at this point. And I think that they're going to be a very interesting side to see develop over the course, if they do get through today, over the course of the rest of this tournament. Right, we'll take a break there. You mentioned Canada. Let's talk a little bit about all three of the hosts when we come back on the other side, and also try and see if there are any dark horses left in this competition. Stick with us. Welcome back to the third and final part of today's Ranks FC. It's Jack Collins and Dean Jones alongside you. And Dean, you mentioned Canada there. Let's start with them. We'll quickly take a flick through the host nations. We've talked a little bit about Mexico as well already. Canada have reached the last 16. I think that they can now comfortably play with a freedom that this World Cup has been a success. I think despite the fact that Canada came into this World Cup, perhaps in maybe not the best nick, but I was the most confident that they would get it right of the three host nations, in that I trusted the program to kind of send it work, send it onwards and make sure that these players knew exactly what they were doing. I think they've already achieved what they set out to achieve, you know, World Cup wins for the first time in front of home fans, going to a knockout stage for the first time, winning a knockout stage game against South Africa and reaching the round of 16. I think it's effectively job done. And that's not me saying that Jesse Marsh will see it like that. I think he will go into this game, as he goes into every game, absolutely convinced that they can turn around an upset for the books. But I think that in many ways, the work has been done for Canada, and they can be proud of their achievement no matter what happens in this next one.
Yeah, I mean, like, the pressure's gone now that they have felt in the past for getting that knockout win, for getting the opener out of the way, for making sure they got through the group. All of those things, there was a sense of pressure on, especially as the other hosts were doing well at the same time. And like, there is a version of Canada that can attack games and that can show a front-footedness that we haven't seen probably enough of so far. The problem is with Canada is that when they doubt themselves, they look an absolute shambles. Like, when they start to lose focus, and when, I don't know, the game plan slightly starts to go awry, they're not a very good team at all. And that's, you know, what they're facing. Morocco is a huge task, because it's, look, we know that the World Cup is a great stage for an upset, but this is really, really going to be an upset if they are to get any further. For me, there have been moments when they've missed too many big opportunities as well in games. Like, that's been something that would concern me. But overall, this World Cup has been a success. It's been a moment when Canadian football will rise. It's brought people together. And Jesse Marsh has come out of it pretty well. Look, Alfonso Davies, obviously, like, if he'd have been more readily available, then I think we would have seen a much more exciting version of Canada, and maybe they could have taken the game to opponents in a way they haven't been able to, because of having to be cautious around how they use him, about whether, even when he's on the field, what he can actually give them. You know, you're not going to see him rattling someone in a 50-50 or anything like that. But if Canada can go be aggressive, if they can, yeah, just take those blips out of their game, then maybe they've caused an upset against Morocco, and have managed to achieve the biggest thing that anyone could have ever imagined them to do at this World Cup by making the quarters.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I talked about kind of par quite a lot, right? And with Mexico and the US, I think the par was slightly different. And again, this isn't to talk down about this Canadian program, because I was hotter on them and more comfortable, I think, with them ahead of this tournament than I was with necessarily the US or Mexico, because I wasn't sure exactly what we were going to get from those two teams. But I think with Canada, I knew what we were going to get, and we've pretty much got that. It's a high-octane team that maybe are not clinical enough in front of goal, but have, you know, put together some really, really impressive performances. I think that they've been really, really quite joyful to watch at times in this tournament. But I think that because they hadn't won a World Cup game, because they'd never got out of a group, in kind of contrast to the other two hosts, Mexico had their own kind of thing, which was, we need to win the fourth game, right, and reach a fifth game for the first time, which they have achieved now. But that was a slightly different thing. I think Canada's was, make sure we get out of the group and see where we go from that point. So they've already kind of surpassed that for me. And I think that's the difference that I would have. I think they go into this one as a free hit, and maybe that makes them more dangerous. We saw that, I think, effectively a little bit with Cap Verde yesterday coming into that Argentina game. They were like, why not? Why not? Why can't we go and do this? And I think Canada will feel very similarly today. But Jesse's You Are Canadian Hero speech, I think, spoke to the fact that he already feels that they've achieved what they needed to do. And I get that it's about riling players up, and I think that all of the backlash to that, etc., was ridiculous in many ways. Like, you can definitely, if that's what's gearing up your team, if that's what's making them kind of gunned and so ready to fight for the badge, then great, do whatever you need for your team. And Jesse understands that better than lots of people commentating on this ever will. So I'm absolutely fine with that. But I think it does maybe belie the fact that, you know, the achievement has already been made by, one, getting out of the group, and two, then winning that first knockout game. I mean, which takes us to Mexico. And I suppose the question I would have is, have the expectations changed? Because I think that, you know, it was about winning that fourth game. It was about getting, you know, to the round of 16. I know they've got to round 16 before and the format changes meant that, you know, it was about getting to the quarterfinals before. Now it's round 16 where you win the fourth game. But winning that knockout game for the first time since 1986 felt like a massive step forward for Mexico. And the way that they played against Ecuador, the first half in particular, was one of the best performances we've seen over 45 minutes from any team at this tournament. Have the expectations shifted now, considering they play at home in this one, and to actually get an England scalp would maybe kind of set this team in folklore?
Oh yeah, if they can do that, then absolutely. I mean, it's about those first 20 minutes, isn't it, in which they just come out with such, I guess before the hydration break, actually, it's almost like that is their period. That the first quarter of a game is when Mexico are able to really assert themselves, particularly in the Azteca, and try to literally leave their opponents breathless. Like, all we're hearing about, particularly now that England are playing there, is like how the atmosphere around that stadium, the altitude, is like so hard for other teams to suffer in. And that is Mexico's game plan, is that like they become insufferable, that they, particularly in first half of games, are just, it's relentless, mate. And they just do not give you a second. England obviously going to have to try to stifle them in that sense and make sure that they're not allowed to do that. England are probably going to have to be pretty boring in the first half of that game. But that's how game plans work out. But you know, the feel good factor among Mexico is unbelievable. Obviously, I see it firsthand here in San Diego because there are so many Mexicans around. You know, there's late night. My friend lives downtown, and he was like, "Oh no, the San Diego FC band have arrived, and they're playing songs late into the night." And he said, "This is winding me up," but. This is what the nation is waiting for. I mean, we've got a load of Mexican fans that listen to Ranks, and I can remember in the past when they're building up to a tournament and expectations were low and it was frustrating because they knew that they had talent. They knew that they had a group that could be brought together and it just wasn't happening. And, you know, they'd suffer defeat to the USMNT and they'd be like, how are we doing this? Why are we losing to them? Why can't we
create something? Top dogs in CONCACAF felt like a really, really big blow to kind of the national pride of what L3 was.
Exactly. And now they have certainly got that national pride. You know, as I've said on the Patreon this week, come and join us, by the way, if you haven't. Like, we've got loads of content over there. But I'm walking around stores and there's just rails and rails of Mexico shirts. And there's lines of people like desperate to make sure that they're showing their colours for this game. And if they can get past England, then honestly, I think they will believe that they can get through the quarters as well.
Yeah, 100%. I think that there is a real belief about that team. I don't think we necessarily need to go over the ground on the USMNT. We did a full podcast on Wednesday, but we're both feeling pretty confident. For those who haven't listened yet, go back and listen to one before, but we're both pretty high on this USMNT team coming into this game against Belgium, which leaves us with our final question really, Dean, which is, are there any dark horses left in this tournament? I have two that I sort of think about here. One is Colombia, who won 1-0 against Ghana, but that scoreline flatters Ghana a little bit. I thought Colombia were the best team in that game by some distance. They are lacking maybe the elite finisher in the number 9 spot, which is, you know, it speaks really kind of badly, I think, on John Duran, who was kind of seen as the heir to that shirt and has just completely fallen off the face of the earth and has just not been able to nail that down. There was high hopes about Luis Suarez, you know, coming in. He was dropped for John Cordoba in this game and then came in 17 minutes in because John Cordoba picked up a really early injury and then, you know, helped to create the goal, but hasn't shown quite the form that he had at Sporting over the course of the last year. That's their only real weakness, though. They're a side that are willing to run at you, to go at you. And if their path continues and they, you know, get through this next round, they would come up against Argentina in the quarterfinals, which is a game they would relish, given the fact that it was the Copa America final from a couple of years ago that they're still feeling a little bit sore about. about, I think, in Colombia. Nestor Lorenzo has done a really good job of turning this team into a fun team that people can watch and get behind and believe in. And they have game changers in a lot of different positions who are able to step up. They've had a couple of the breakout stars of the tournament. I think Gustavo Puerta has been absolutely sensational in taking Richard Rios's spot. Bear in mind, he's a player who was playing in the Spanish second tier for all of last season at Racing Santander, helped them get promoted, but has walked in here, taken Richard Rios, who obviously plays at Benfica, taking his spot and be like, thank you very much. I'm the guy in this position now. And I think he's been absolutely phenomenal. Colombia looked to me like one of the fun outside bets, I think.
Yeah, they are, more so than Switzerland. I fancy him to beat Switzerland. And then give Argentina a good game, to be honest. And the one after that is what, if that's what we expect to open up Argentina in the next round, then I would expect that Colombia goes head to head and show that they are as exciting a South American team as you could hope to see at that stage to take on Messi and co and knock them out and make it through. I don't quite think it will happen, but Colombia have such a good following. You've seen the scenes that have followed them around all their stadiums. They had a good group stage, won two games, dominated Portugal. They haven't set the world alight, but they also haven't done anything particularly bad to think that they can't make it through. So, yeah, as a dark horse, I guess they would probably be my pick.
I think the thing about that game is it has both of them in it. These are the two teams I would maybe look at as dark horses. And we've just seen Argentina kind of run to the wire by Cap Verde. Colombia and Switzerland, I think, whoever gets through this game will fancy their chances. And Switzerland put together a very, very vintage Swiss performance to put away Algeria. If you'd asked me what the score was going to be in that game, I was like, if everything goes to the book, 2-0 Switzerland. If it's 4-3, Algeria will probably win. But if it's, you know, a game that goes to standard... Yeah. The Swiss are incredibly comfortable in their own skin. They've got Johan Manzambi, who sets up the first goal here, who's been another of these breakout stars of the tournament. Whoever gets through this game between Colombia and Switzerland, I think will fancy their chances against Argentina. That doesn't mean they'll win, but I think they will fancy their chances of going in there and giving them a game. And it wouldn't stun me if one of those two sides ended up in a semi-final, I think, at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably the best way to look at it. I mean, it's not a game... When you look at some of the games we've got coming up, it's not one that's going to be ranked number one, but actually there's so much at stake for both of those teams that it should actually be extremely dramatic. Mate, what an unbelievable World Cup. Like, just to round this up, like, as I was saying at the start about the people that were watching that Cape Verde game with me, like, they were like, is every World Cup this good? And I was like, obviously for me, yes, but like, I'm not sure it is for a neutral, no.
I don't know. Like, I struggle to remember. Maybe I'm just, as you say, you know, too far deep in it to not, but I struggle to remember a World Cup I didn't just really enjoy.
I mean, time zones do play a difference, and maybe it's because Americans are able to actually watch it all free and easy here and they're not having to like stay up late to get involved. That probably is part of it.
Yeah, 100%. How many of the games last time out would have been at, you know, 1 in the morning, and that was or like 6 in the morning in some regards. So yeah, I suppose that does play into it, you know, and that's part of it being shared around the world. But yeah, I'm grateful that there has been such take up from so many different people and speaking to a variety of people kind of around the States in particular, you know, seeing the buy-in that we're getting from so many different people is such a wonderful thing to kind of see. And look, I'm going to be seeing it in the flesh tomorrow onwards. So I'm very, very excited about being on the ground at this.
I'm excited for you, mate.
First time. My first ever time at a World Cup, which is very special, right? Like, and I think it's a nice moment to be in that kind of bubble. So
you'll love just being on the time zone, mate. You really will. Like, just feeling part of it, like... In England, you definitely have a separation that people are struggling with. And honestly, like, once you're among it in America, like, it has been way better than I think a lot of people imagined it would be. It's helped with the US having a good tournament, of course. But it's captured people in a way that I didn't imagine it would, even games that aren't involving the US. So you're going to absolutely love it, mate.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a whole lot of fun. We'll be doing some updates from over in the States as well, bringing the microphone with me. A lot of those will be over on the Patreon. So if you haven't, still a great time to come and join us over there, not just for the end of this World Cup, but also for the transfer window that follows. You'll have Dean Jones Transfer Guru's updates on all all the goings on in the transfer world, which helps us tick through those months until the season begins again. But for now, all that's left for me to do is say a massive thank you to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. Happy 4th of July to all of our American listeners. I hope you're all having a wonderful holiday weekend. And thank you all so much for listening. We'll see you all very shortly, Rank Squad. Take it easy. Peace.